Welcome to Empowered From Within, a special series under Unapologetically Hers 2024-2025 Participatory Action Research Leadership Program. I'm your host, Precious Johnson, and I bring both experience and commitment to this critical conversation. This series is based on research conducted by incarcerated community researchers at Central California Women's Facility, exploring peer perspectives on job readiness and accessing current prison programs. Their findings highlight both the barriers to reentry and opportunities for change. Over 10 episodes, you'll hear firsthand from those currently incarcerated and those who have successfully reentered society. We'll examine challenges in job readiness programs, discuss access and equity in prison education, and explore ways to create real systematic change. Join us as we amplify these voices and push for meaningful action. Let's dive in. Welcome to Empower From Within, Peer Research on Job Readiness, a podcast series from the 2024-25 Participatory Action Research Leadership Program, or PARLEP, by Unapologetically Hers. I'm your host, Precious Johnson. Today's episode is titled Workforce from Within, How PARLEP Prepares Incarcerated Leaders for Meaningful Careers. In this episode, we're providing an overview of PARLEP, what it is, how participants are selected, the benefits of participating, how they gather feedback, and actions you can take to support job readiness for people inside Central California Women's Facility. I'm honored to be joined by Amina Elser, co-founder and executive director of Unapologetically Hers. She brings visionary leadership and lived experience as someone formerly incarcerated. Welcome, Amina.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I'm excited to be here and just having this conversation with you.
Yeah. Thank you for being a part of this conversation. It's critical. It's much needed for folks inside and the folks outside that want to get a part of this movement. Let's start by grounding this conversation in your personal story. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to create PARLEP? And for our listeners that don't know what PARLEP is, what is PARLEP? And, you know, just give me a personal story, like who you are and how you be, you know, how you created this wonderful program.
So thank you. Thank you for these questions. So as you said, my name is Mina Elster, she, her pronouns. I come to this work through my own lived experience as a formerly incarcerated Black woman. And, you know, it was really during my final year in college where I participated in a few peer-led research projects. These projects were collaborations between the Institute for Research and Labor and Employment at Berkeley and then and the Underground Scholars. So we had a team of formerly incarcerated scholars, and our team conducted interviews with college-educated, formerly incarcerated people that were looking for employment opportunities. Our team synthesized the data we got from those stakeholders, and we drafted some policy briefs around criminal record stigma in the college-educated labor market. And I remember thinking to myself at this time, like, I wish I could have participated and contributed to change on this level while I was inside, because you didn't need like to have a laptop or access to internet in order to talk to people, in order to utilize your critical thinking skills and to be able to write. So after I finished school, I started working as a policy coordinator for the California Coalition of Prisoners. Mm-hmm. And through that work, I saw how powerful research could be in driving policy change and wanted to bring that skill to people that were still inside. You also asked about like, what is, you know, for those that don't know. And I just wanted to say, like, it's in the name too. PARLEP is a leadership development program for incarcerated people in California women's prisons. And it simply trains community researchers in research, communication, and critical thinking. PAR stands for Participatory Action Research, which is a method where the people most impacted by issues lead the process. And it's participatory, it is action orientated and collaborative, and it's an iterative process. So it's a cycle. And our community researchers follow a 7-step research process to identify issues, gather stories, analyze their findings, and really push for change that matters to them.
Thank you for sharing that breakdown and just giving us your background into how this baby was created, right? You know, it's really important that the folks that are mostly impacted by these systems and, you know, policies and procedures be the voice of reason, right? And the voice of change. And so I think that that was a brilliant idea to get people involved that are actually directly impacted by, you know, the environment that they live in. And it sounds like that's what type of program you created.
Yes, absolutely. Let's give the power back to folks who, you know, best suited to build or tackle issues here.
Right. So how does these two connect? How does leadership development and participatory action research connect? Like, how do they collide and how do they prepare folks specifically for, you know, being released in the workforce and just professional development? Like, how do those two really connect and prepare folks?
Well, PAR at its essence is action research. And essentially, it's helping to develop. So in the process of doing PAR, folks must learn. They learn research methods. They learn how to identify stakeholders, who's a stakeholder. They learn how to recognize patterns or themes, I mean, or coded research to read codes. All of these skills are transferable once they are released. I mean, I think largely we sometimes don't think about it, but like in work of doing nonprofit work or even in government or, you know, small business work, oftentimes folks are doing evaluations on their programs. So, you know, they're evaluating programs. So community researchers are learning tools of evaluation because the research, the data analysis, the community engagement and talking to people, those are skills that you not only do inside, but you can, it transfers on the outside that but folks can use in their consulting and things like that. So I would say in that way, the job development and PAR is connected.
Yeah, it sounds like you were hoping to fill a gap, you know, in existing reentry or workforce development programs that were present inside or that were just lacking thereof of those two elements. I hope I heard you correctly. And is that true for you, that you were trying to fill like a gap?
No, it was definitely a gap. So doing policy work and noticing like there was a huge gap, especially when it came to data about people who are incarcerated in women's prisons. So we really needed a program that was led by folks inside and built around advocacy and skill development so that, you know, community researchers have real skills, increased confidence and experience that they could use inside and out.
That sounds like something that folks definitely really participated in, right? And it was a need for it. And I'm just, thank you. Thank you for sharing, just like laying that all out for our listeners. Can you describe the recruitment process for PARLUP? Like, what do you look for in potential participants? Like, when you created this program, how did you foresee picking people, right? Because everybody's not a researcher, right? Everybody's not like curious about what's going on in prison, you know, and talking to several people over this podcast series, people are lacking motivation, right? Inside and lacking job skills and just lacking a lot of things. And so for you in creating this program, like how did you foresee picking folks for this process, this 12-month process?
Yeah. So I do want to clarify, like it could be 12 months depending on what we're working on. But a lot of times, a lot of our cohorts are between 6 to 8. And the recruitment process may look different depending on the project focus. So sometimes there's targeted outreach. Maybe we're targeting a certain group of people that have experience with a certain issue. Just say, what if it was reproductive justice? And those that, you know, had direct lived experience with reproductive justice issues while in prison, maybe we do targeted outreach. Other times we will rely on our networks inside or alumni of the program to either provide nominations. So nominate people for the program. And as that, those people are serving as ambassadors and kind of sharing about what the program is about and nominating folks or either sharing recommendations. We send in, knowing that research isn't for everyone, I think also taking into consideration, like some folks just are not aware of what it means to be a researcher or the type of research that we're doing. So after folks learn about, hey, this isn't the boring kind of research that's done in institutions, educational institutions. This is like, you know, participatory. It is collaborative. It is different. You know, I think more folks are eager to learn and come on board. But so those are the two recruitment processes. And though applicants are required to submit like a 500 word essay plus mm-hmm. two letters of recommendations from peers inside. And those who move forward will have a phone interview or a video interview. So we're looking for people that's already leading inside. Mm-hmm. You know, they are, you know, serious and committed to peer advocacy and helping one another, and also eager to grow and develop professionally and as a leader.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It sounds like you got your criteria, you know, down packed in. And also, like, how does that help folks prepare for the outside world, right? With the resumes, the interviews, the essay, the, in essence, a reference, right? They got to be referred for the program. So that's almost like a reference with them not even knowing. How is that mm-hmm. helping folks once they come home to prepare for jobs and interviews and stuff like that?
Right, exactly. So in prison, like, you're not doing none of that. You're not filling out an application. You're not, you know, submitting resumes and hoping that you get interviewed. Hey, you're getting a ducat and this is where you show up the next day. And that's that. Right. So I've noticed, you know, a lot of times when folks get out, because there's no interviewing skills for folks in there. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And to get a job, you don't have to do a resume. You don't have to do a cover letter. You don't have to do any of that. So this also gives them the practice that they need, or we're introducing it to them while they're inside, so that they will know what to expect when they get out too. You know, it's a competitive world. It's a competitive process. And this is how you show up. You know, this is what you do. You know, you may have to do some scenario write-up exercises for a job. You're going to have to do some interviews and show up and navigate technology challenges and all of that, you know. So it's really giving people real experience.
Real experience and skills, mm-hmm. right? Valuable skills they're going to need once they come home. What are some of those skills they're gaining through this program? I mean, if you don't mind elaborating on that a little bit.
Yeah. So folks are learning like critical thinking skills, how to think critically about issues or even more broadly while they're doing like topic maps or thinking and imagining about stakeholders and identifying stakeholders. Folks are learning how to engage their peers and one another. Sometimes it's people that they never even thought about engaging before. So how do you step outside of yourself and engage folks and put like your community first? They're learning how to, you know, basically conduct research and create research protocols. They're learning how to write, how to, you know, structure questions, the difference between open-ended, closed-ended questions. And then also how to look for analyzed data, how to look for themes and noticing like when I have all these folks, they're all saying the same thing. How do I elevate this, or how do I use this for change? But even bigger than that, too, because we work in a space where it's really movement driven. And a lot of the work outside with, you know, social justice agencies that Unapologetically HERS works with, really working to, you know, support people inside of women's prisons. So how do we do this work in support of the greater goal, which is to essentially close down women's prisons? But how do we help develop the data to push and give momentum, put momentum under the various movements for liberation?
Right. Now I kind of want to shift to like some research methods that folks utilize. You know, we are on the fourth cohort right now, and this one's surrounded, you know, about job readiness, and it's a podcast, right, series. What are some of the other methods that folks use inside to gather feedback, and what types of reports or things that they create to disseminate into their population, into folks on the outside that are interested in this work? What kind of other methods did folks use inside?
Yeah, so particularly for this cohort on job readiness, the community researchers, they co-designed the interview protocol. The interview protocol is essentially like identifying questions that they wanted to ask people in their community around the different topics that you'll hear throughout the podcast. They led community engagement efforts. So they went out into community to actually like talk to stakeholders, identify stakeholders, talk to stakeholders. They held the stakeholder interviews using motivational interviewing and note-taking. So they paired up where one community researcher facilitated the interview and another one took notes and then analyzed the interview responses to identify the key themes and surface actionable insights around their theme for job readiness. So that was the method that this cohort used. Other methods before they've used surveys, they did focus groups, and even interviews.
Okay, thank you for sharing that and breaking that down, you know, for folks that really don't know, right? Like, what is research and how do folks do research inside? And so that was very helpful. What kinds of like careers or roles are people inside most interested in pursuing? I know before I got out 2 years ago, I was interested in advocacy and policy and legislation and things of that nature, even being like a director, right? An executive director. That was something that I wanted to pursue too until I came home and noticed that there's other roles that I, you know, that fit my professional development and my skill set. What are some of the roles and careers that folks inside are saying that they are most interested in? And can you kind of give me an elaboration on like why they're choosing those type of roles and careers?
Yeah, doing the application process, this is one question that we asked applicants too, because we were really curious about, you know, what type of professional careers did folks imagine themselves in when they released? And in turn, they asked their peers the same question. And like majority of folks identified peer support specialist roles. And I'm going to say, I believe that a lot of folks chose, you know, peer support specialist roles. One is because that is has recently been a new program instituted in CCWF where they certify peer support specialists. And, you know, folks are really, you know, committed to supporting their peers. There's also a need to be work in nonprofits or be a director or work with youth, but some kind of nonprofit work. And I think that's also because, you know, there people may know, you know, some nonprofits that are doing work inside or know some people that they've done time with who went into that role. There's a SUD, so substance use disorder counselors. And I think that's because there's the OMCP program in there. And, you know, it's a really competitive program. People go into it and people are under the assumption, like when you get out too, maybe you're going to make some good money. And then many are interested in really pursuing their higher education or even launching their own business. Mm-hmm. But I think like folks are choosing these because this may be all that they really know, mm-hmm. you know, not having a broader vision of what's out there and like what's possible. I think people are kind of limited in their imagining and what's possible for them after release.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. There's, like you said in your previous statement, you know, you get a job, Ducky, this is where you're going to go work, right? And then they're also presenting to you certain roles, like you said, the substance abuse counselors, the peer support specialists, and, you know, it's what is being put in front of them. That's what's influencing them, you know, in their career choices. What are some of the barriers, right? Like, what are some of the barriers participants shared around preparing for employment while incarcerated? Like, what are folks saying are the barriers that they are faced with in preparing for employment and their release?
Well, I think one of the biggest barriers is there's a lack of job readiness opportunities to begin with. And then coupled with like outdated vocational training, where you're being certified inside and these certifications don't carry or they're not even recognized once you get out. And then like I took carpentry inside and got certified, but my plan wasn't, I'm not going to go out there and become a carpenter. So there's this mismatch. Then there's of course lack of access to technology. So, you know, the technology is a big one. However, it's balancing, you know, open technology or open access to technology in a prison where security is number one. So how do we create access? So there's lack of access to technology, which for folks are just not learning basic technology skills. And then there's like extremely long wait list for some programs. And then like certain people, certain sentences. So people convicted of life without the possibility of parole are being denied opportunities to certain trainings or learning opportunities due to their sentence.
I totally agree with you, Amina, on that. You know, when I was inside, I had a life sentence and I wanted to do cosmetology. You know, I did hair and I was very young and could not get into cosmetology because they did not want to license a lifer, right? And so that is, those barriers are in place that I personally experienced as well. In addition to that, like you, you did carpentry, you came home and that's not something that you were going to do, right? You wanted to be a carpenter. I was cleaning inside. I was making dentures inside. And those are things that I did not come home and do, right? And so, like you said, the mismatched skills and not do it, and they should do assessments of some sort and say, hey, what are you good at? And this is where we should place you. Like there's a lot of holes and gaps that are not preparing folks for the real world and real jobs. Right. And reentry. So now I want to turn to like, what are some of the challenges, right? What are some of the challenges that PART is faced with in terms of like the institution, right? The GTL. I know that we're trying to do workshops inside and, you know, we're being hit with lack of funding and lack of staffing and all these things. What are some challenges that are putting, you know, that are put in front of us as we're trying to prepare folks for professional development, reentry, and just job readiness in its totality?
Yeah, and I'll go back to, you know, that balance between, like, we know prisons are do not serve to rehabilitate people. So really their purpose is to secure people, lock them up, and their number one goal is, or their focus is on security. So I think some challenges, like you said before, it's like budget cuts. So CDCR is allegedly experiencing budget cuts. And, you know, when the prison has budget cuts, that means staff shortages. When there's staff shortages, that trickles down to if people are able to, you know, even get out of their rooms, if there's even movement like on the main yard, or if there's an escort that could escort us inside the prison to whatever space we need to go in to conduct a workshop. And then, you know, a lot of our work happens over like GTL, the Getting Out app, which allows us to send emails to folks inside. A lot of times, you know, the system is down, or, you know, then they are monitoring what kind of language folks use and are not allowing people's emails to get out in a timely fashion. Sometimes, you know, images, we try to send images in, and there's a whole system for how images get approved. So that's a delay there. And then we also rely on snail mail to get things, to get information back and forth. So I think those are some of the issues or challenges we have with getting access to folks inside, and then just even making sure that folks are getting information that they need in a timely manner.
It's funny that, you know, they're going through budget and funding issues when there's a $14 billion budget, you know, and less than 5% of that budget goes towards rehabilitation. You know, it's just such a disparity. It's just such a barrier for folks to really be prepared to come home and really just be successful and to keep those recidivism rates down, right?
Right.
And so I know that through your program, you offer a $500 stipend. Can you talk about what that means to participants and how it impacts their engagement?
Yeah, so we do. We offer folks a $500 stipend because we want them to know that, hey, one, we value your time, we value your energy, we value your labor and work that you are putting into like this program. So it really signals that their work is valuable. We've seen like it helps to boost confidence and reinforces, you know, the expectation of fair compensation, which is something, you know, I believe folks that leave from incarceration should have, because there's a lot of opportunities once they get out to be tokenized in a way that is really not, you know, helpful to them and can be re-traumatizing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, it's really rare to be paid for your mind while you're still inside. Mm-hmm. So, you know, being able to provide this stipend helps to change how our community researchers really view themselves in relation to the larger advocacy work and world in general.
Absolutely. You know, I talked to, you know, someone inside during this episode series, this podcast series, and one thing she said is like, can we get at least minimum wage? You know, they're getting 8 cents, they're getting 11 cents, they're getting 24 cents, they're getting 80 cents. They, you know, the highest paying job is a dollar. And so I think providing those stipends to folks inside is really giving them a sense of like, hey, folks out there really do value us, you know, and that is rebuilding their confidence. So I think that's an awesome thing that you're doing. What are some actions organizations, employers, or advocates can take to support job readiness inside facilities like CCWF?
Yeah, so some actions, some things that folks can take is fund peer-led programs like PARLOR, right? You know, where we're giving folks real, tangible, transferable workforce development skills and compensating folks for their time and labor. There's other organizations also out there doing similar work. CCWP is one. I believe Ella Baker Center also has a fellowship for folks on the inside. So fun, these organizations doing this important work. And then there's this need. There's all this movement and we hear a lot of talk about fair chance hiring. What would it look like to host a job fair inside of CCWF or CIW where employers are coming? You're transparent about the salary. You're sharing information about the cost of living in the region so that folks can get a real, like, you know, honest, you know, look at, you know, what it would look like to parole to certain areas in relation to the type of jobs that they are seeking. Mm-hmm. And this would, you know, and also to support realistic short-term skill-based trainings that leads to real jobs for folks inside. So those are some of the actions that employers and organizations can take to really support job readiness for folks inside of CCWF.
Absolutely. Like, I agree with you with every point that you just made, you know, as being formerly incarcerated and not having any of those things when I was inside a fellowship, you know, job resource fairs, resource conferences, any of those things. I think those things would have made a huge difference. And they're going to make a huge difference in folks' time and really preparing them for this workforce status ever changing with AI and technology, and, you know, it's forever changing with this politics and our president and all these things that are going on, right? And we want folks to come home prepared. We right. want folks to come home prepared. So what's one lesson or insight from this cohort that you hope listeners take away from these critical conversations?
Well, I think one, or maybe a few. One takeaway that I have is that, you know, leadership doesn't begin when someone gets out of prison. It begins when someone is given the tools and opportunity to really rise. And, you know, hence when we invest in people inside, we really transform not just individuals, but entire systems.
Yes, that's beautiful. I agree. Is there any other thoughts, anything else you would like to share that we haven't covered in this conversation?
Yes. Just really quick. I just wanted to just share some of the other like key benefits of participating in PARLOP, you know, outside of the economic empowerment. Of course, that's that professional growth and the training and research. And there's that community, that leadership development, you know, that's gaining experience and they lead peer research and shape and advocacy. You know, we talked about confidence and purpose. So really engaging in this work helps create change and build self-worth, motivation, and a strong sense of purpose. And, you know, PARLOP fosters connection, mentorship, and collaboration inside and out. And, you know, we just really prepare our community researchers for real-world tools they can use in nonprofit work, consulting, advocacy, and beyond.
Thank you so much, Amina, for sharing those reflections, those insights, and just really breaking this program down for our listeners.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation, you know, and chatting with you. And I just, you know, look forward to talking more.
Today, we explored how leadership and workforce readiness are being cultivated from within through Parla. People inside are prepared for not just for release, but for roles as leaders, researchers, and advocates. To learn more about Unapologetically Hers and support peer-led programs like Parlup, visit uahers.org. Be sure to tune in to Empower From Within, share this series, and join us next time for more conversations on transforming not just job readiness, but what it looks like behind prison walls. Thank you for tuning in to Empower From Within. A special thank you to our guests for sharing their invaluable insights and our community researchers, and to our listeners for being part of this critical conversation. If you believe in the power of self-empowerment and the importance of job readiness for system-impacted individuals, visit uahers.org to learn more, share your feedback, get involved, or support this work. Don't forget to subscribe and join us next time as we continue exploring the realities of reentry, workforce readiness, and the systematic changes needed to build a more just future.